Welcome to the Tennis Worthy Podcast, brought to you by the International Tennis Hall of Fame. I'm Patrick McEnroe, the president of the Hall of Fame, and here in the United States, we're celebrating Women's History Month. This week, we're focusing largely on an era where a generation of female players laid the foundations for tennis to be a pioneering sport for women as much as it was a sport for men.
The ladies who played games before the First World War didn't have the chance of doing jobs during the war where girls got into trousers and slacks. I mean, the land girls who went on the land didn't wear trailing skirts. They wore some form of trouser, you see, and that's what changed things enormously. They took on jobs which nobody in the early century would have thought women could ever do. And I'm sure that's what changed an awful lot of the apparel of people after the war, in this country anyhow.
In the 1920s, there were the sport's first superstars, Bill Tilden, Bill Johnston, Vinnie Richards, and later in the decade, the four French Musketeers. But the women also had a great generation, headed by Suzanne Longlin, Kitty Godfrey, Helen Wills, and the doubles specialist Bunny Ryan. In the centenary year of Kitty Godfrey's second Wimbledon singles title and historic mixed doubles triumph, our Chris Bowers digs out a fascinating interview with Godfrey from the Hall of Fame archive and profiles the third woman of 1920s tennis.
The First World War marks a real dividing line in the early history of tennis. Before it, there'd been 40 years of the sport developing to the point where, in 1913, the first global governing body was founded, the International Lawn Tennis Federation, today's ITF. But after the war, there was a real boom, almost an explosion of pent-up energy, in which the sport's stars emerged onto a global canvas, alongside the emergence of film stars such as Charlie Chaplin, Buster Keaton and others. Unlike any other sport, the women matched the men for star names, and one of them was Kitty McCain. McCain was 3 years older than her great rival, Suzanne Longlin, and 10 years younger than her other big rival, Helen Wills. So where did she learn her tennis? A question put to her in this 1981 interview when a sprightly 85-year-old Kitty spoke with Bud Lesser.
Well, we didn't learn in those days, you know. I mean, this coaching that goes on now is quite extraordinary to my mind. I played a little at school, but not very much. I was at school until the beginning of the First World War. Then during the war, I had one or two jobs to do, wartime jobs. And then after the war, which was 1919, I started playing tennis and played in some tournaments in England leading up to Wimbledon, where I was lucky enough to get in because in those days, there were no qualifying rounds. So whether I would have got in or not, I don't know, but I got straight in.
What was your first year of competition?
Well, that would be 1919. I remember playing Suzanne Longlin in about the third round. I think I was lucky enough to get through two rounds, and I met her in the third round and was very easily defeated. But then, as you remember, she went on to win the championship, playing a magnificent game against Mrs. Lambert Chambers, who was the holder. Since before the war, she held it all through the war years. And they had a very good final, which I remember watching. And Mrs. Lambert Chambers had two match points in the third set. And Suzanne was looking very exhausted and very tired. However, she just managed to save those two match points, and she won the match 7-5 in the final set. It was a very fine single.
Did you know Mrs. Lambert on a personal basis?
I knew her well, yes.
Was she a tremendously well-disciplined athlete?
Oh, very. She was essentially a baseline player. Before the war, not many people volleyed, just a few outstanding players. But she did learn to volley after the war, and she learned to serve overarm. And she, in fact, captained the Wacken Cup team in 1925, I think I'm right in saying, which is the year that we won it in the States. She was a very good captain.
You played tennis and were a champion long before it became the popular sport it is today.
Oh, yes, long before it as it is today, I agree. It was very popular, and people played, of course, more for the love of the game. And many of us played because we enjoyed it and because we traveled abroad, which one couldn't have done unless your expenses were paid. And if you represented your country, then the Lawn Tennis Association, in England anyhow, I don't know about other countries, paid your travelling expenses and your other expenses because you were part of the international team. And that's what gave me the opportunity of travelling all over Europe and three times to the States and to South Africa and to Canada. So I had a very, very enjoyable 10 years. And I think what improved me mostly was playing against men friends who were definitely stronger, but not too frightfully strong, so that the rallies that we had, I was stretched to the full, but I could get to them and get them back, you see, and that speeded up my game enormously.
Without showing an ankle, I hope, in those days.
Mid-calf. Yes, no, the dresses that were down to the ankles were finished as soon as Suzanne came on the scene, because she only wore them half-calf. But you must remember, the ladies who played games before the First World War didn't have the chance of doing jobs during the war where girls got into trousers and slacks. I mean, the land girls who went on the land didn't wear trailing skirts. They wore some form of trouser, you see, and that's what changed things enormously. They took on jobs which nobody in the early century would have thought women could ever do. And I'm sure that's what changed an awful lot of the apparel of people after the war, in this country anyhow.
How about the attitude? Now, when you came to the United States, your team had chaperones and...
Well, we had a manager of the first team in 1923, which was the first Whiteman Cup match. Had Mr. and Mrs. Sabelli, and he was the secretary of the Lawn Tennis Association. And he came as manager, and she came, to help out and help look after the girls. I don't think any of the girls were married. And there might have been, yes, there might have been two of them who were married, and two of us were still single. And he did all the managing of the finances and looking after the luggage and that sort of thing. And then the next time we went abroad was in 25, when we had Mr. and Mrs. Lambert Chambers. And they were both excellent. Mrs. Lambert Chambers was a marvellous captain. And then in 1927, yes, we still had a manager. There were six of us then, with a manager to look after all the details. So really, we were very spoiled. It was a marvellous time.
Now, in 1923, you English girls did very badly.
Very.
Against Helen Wills and Mrs. Mallory and Helen Hotchkiss Whiteman. But you build up from that point. How did you do it?
Well, I think we did more badly in 23 than perhaps we need have done, because that was our first time ever abroad, you see. And, you know, it's very different out there, isn't it? You've got to get used to it.
Where was it played?
It was played at Forest Hills, which was a very nice club, just about, 20 minutes outside New York by the electric train. We stayed in the Forest Hills Hotel, and we enjoyed it immensely. But, of course, we did have a pretty strong opposition, didn't we?
Were you English girls courted by the stage door Johnnies in America?
No, we weren't. We were rather... I suppose we were young and inexperienced, and we stuck together.
She was born Kathleen McCain in London in May 1896 and had a reasonably affluent childhood. She was known at home as Biddy. The name Kitty only came later from the media when they took an interest in her tennis exploits. And she and her sister had a governess. Her father had a business importing pianos from Berlin. And he had some strong views about bringing up girls in late Victorian and Edwardian England. Helen Godfrey was McCain's daughter-in-law. She knew her for 30 years and lived under the same roof for 16 of them.
I think she had an exceptional childhood for a woman born in 1896. She had a father who believed that his daughter should have the same opportunity to play sport as boys. And so from a young age, they had both her sister Margaret, who was 12 and a half months older than her, and my mother-in-law, played various forms of sport. They skated from quite a young age. They went abroad and skied, I believe. And, of course, the bicycle was a large part of their lives, although at that time it probably wasn't considered a sport. But she cycled from her very early years until she was 95.
They had a family business to do with pianos in Berlin.
They did, indeed. And they cycled to Berlin when girls were apparently about 9 and 10.
They cycled from London to Berlin.
They probably, I don't quite know how they went to Harwich, but they went to Harwich and they crossed to the Hook, Holland. And the governess, my mother-in-law, her sister and the parents rode their bikes all the way to Berlin, basically stopping each night at a bed and breakfast, except at the weekends they did something more enjoyable.
So she must have been very, very fit before her 10th birthday.
Yes, I imagine she was. She'd already won one of the earliest skating awards given to children or given to girls.
Now, there must have been a fairly affluent childhood if her father is running a business involving importing pianos from Berlin. But then how did the outbreak of the First World War affect the family?
Adversely. It very adversely affected them. They lived in a very nice place in the Kensington area, and I think they had a house near Henley. And after the First World War, things were very different, and my mother's mother had to start doing bridge parties, my mother-in-law, and other ways of making money, because obviously the business was completely gone. I think it impacted the family enormously, and big change of lifestyle for the girls.
In that context, the focus on tennis was a welcome relief, and in 1920, she won the Olympic doubles gold medal in Antwerp, the first of five Olympic medals she won, three in Antwerp, and two more 4 years later in Paris. For the first half of the 1920s, McCain found herself challenging the dominance of the balletic Frenchwoman Suzanne Longlen and the precocious, poker-faced Californian Helen Wills. McCain and Wills first played each other in the inaugural USA versus Great Britain Whiteman Cup in 1923, when Wills was 17 and McCain 27. McCain had just reached the Wimbledon final, where it had taken the then unbeatable Longlen to defeat her 6-2, 6-2. 5 weeks later, she faced the American prodigy, Wills winning 2-6, 6-2, 7-5. Wills, in fact, had led the final set 5-1 before McCain turned it into a cliffhanger.
She beat me in 23.
How did she beat you? Just by standing on the back line and hammering
away? No, she came up to it when she had to come up. I don't think she really liked being in the net as much as at the back of the court, because her ground strokes are absolutely marvellous. She hits so hard and so accurately. But if she was drawn up to the net, which is what I tried to do, she wasn't a very good runner. But if she got there, then you had to lob over her head. And that was, I thought, one of the ways to beat her. But then you've got to be jolly accurate to be able to do that. But she won by playing better than I did.
But McCain got the better of Wills the following year. She'd entered the Grand Slam Roll of Honour in 1923 by winning the US women's doubles title with Phyllis Covell and very nearly pulling off the mixed too, she and the Australian John Hawkes losing 10-8 final set to the American legends Molla Mallory and Bill Tilden. At age 28, she faced Wills in the Wimbledon final of 1924. The American took the first set 6-4, but McCain found a way of turning the match round.
I hadn't got a temperament that got angry. I got a bit annoyed with myself. I lost the first set easily and was well down in the second. And then I remember saying to myself, well, this is ridiculous. You're going to lose if you go on like this. So you've got to change your game and do something else. And then I think the luck turned. I seem to remember there was a net called in my favour. And another shot that I hit as hard as I could, hit the line, sent up chalk, and then things began to turn round. And it's always much more difficult if you've got well ahead of somebody and then they gradually begin to overhaul you and you feel awfully nervous about it. Oh, now, what's going to happen? Why am I not doing as well? And then you begin to miss a few yourself. And that turned both those matches round, actually. all because being behind to then come forward and then overtake.
She also picked up the mixed doubles title at Wimbledon that year, she and Brian Gilbert beating in the final Dorothy Shepherd and a certain Leslie Godfrey, who we'll come back to in a minute. In 1925, McCain reached the final of both the singles and doubles at the first ever French Championships. The tournament had existed since 1891, but up to 1925, it was only open to members of French clubs. In 1925, it went truly international, which added greater weight to Suzanne Longlen's fifth French title. In the final, she trounced McCain 6-1, 6-2. So what did McCain make of La Divine, or the Goddess, the nickname by which Longlen was known?
In appearance, she was a dancer, a ballet dancer. And she carried that onto the court. I mean, I don't know why she did. She may have danced in her youth, I don't know. But she danced on the tennis court beautifully. She had a very nice figure. She dressed in those days beautifully. Her dresses were mid-calf, which was short for the pre-war people's dresses. She wore always white, but a cardigan and a chiffon scarf over her head to match. And she could change them from blue, you see, to orange or to red or whatever she fancied. She had very nice grey eyes, and they really were very nice grey eyes. But apart from that, she was not a good-looking girl. But her whole tout ensemble on the court, to me, was most attractive. As for her play, I always felt when I played her that if I won a point from her, I jolly well won it. It was a good shot and something she couldn't get, because she never gave you a point at all. I can't remember her serving a double fault. I don't think she ever hit the return of service into the net, and she kept a steady baseline within 6 inches of the baseline all the way through. If she came to the net, well, then she volleyed beautifully and always like a ballet dancer. So in my view, and I've seen this first-class tennis since 1919, I would say that Suzanne had every shot that there was to have. I mean, you can't do more than so much with a racket and a tennis ball, and she could do it all. She didn't hit as hard as they do nowadays. She ran just as well. She used her head even better, because you never knew what was coming next from her. And I think the present-day players, you nearly always do know what's coming next. And I think that if she was 20, if she had the modern rackets, the modern balls, and I suppose the modern court, I don't know. And I must say the incentive of £10,000 to win, I think that she would beat them, or she would be very close. I think she's, in every way, I think she's the best player there's ever been. But you can't compare how she played from the point of view of speed with today, because she hadn't got the facilities for that. You see, the ball was blown up a bit harder in about 1936 or 7. And the rackets are better than they were. And I think the shoes are probably better than they were. And certainly the chances of playing, I mean, are better. And of course, there's such a terrific amount of money that the incentive is so much more. So I think that she would have been at the top if she had been alive today at the age of 20.
You speak of her different scarves of rainbow hue. How about her moods?
Oh, her moods were really more to do with health than with temperament. I don't think temperament is the right word to use compared with what you see nowadays, because she was quite quiet. I played her, 7 or 8 or 9 times in singles, and there was no temperament at all on the court. There was no look or argument or discussion about lines or anything like that.
McCain never beat Longlen in those 8 or 9 singles, though she did have the odd win over her in doubles, albeit never at one of the majors. Longlen was the towering women's figure in 1920s tennis, and in 1926 she made headlines both on the French Riviera and at Wimbledon. In February, she beat Wills in Cannes in what many people still call the match of the century, the only time Longlen and Wills ever played each other. Longlen won 6-3, 8-6, but the drama came when Longlen thought she'd won 7-5, only for the linesman to signal that he'd called Wills's cross-court forehand in, and the call of out that everyone had heard had come from the crowd. The match resumed amid great drama, but Longlen won two games later and was the toast of France. However, 4 months later, she was the villain of England, after an incident at Wimbledon involving the wife of King George V that McCain witnessed at close hand.
Well, that's rather a long story, and I must say I am on Suzanne's side in many of these events. You see, normally speaking, you're supposed to go to the referee before you leave the ground in the evening and say, when am I wanted tomorrow? But she really hardly had to do that because the referee or somebody on the committee went to her and said, Suzanne, you're down to play there and there. Is that all right? Does that suit you? You see, I don't know that they ever had any discussion, but nothing ever seemed to upset her until this one occasion. She was down to play a not very good player at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And she was then down to play a very, very hard ladies' double at about 4:30 or 5 in the evening. And the ladies' double was almost, you might say, the final because they had drawn the best American pair. There was no seeding in those days, that's why, you see. Well, she didn't know this until the next morning. And somebody rang her up and said, I say, you see, you're down to play your single at 2 and then the double at 5. What about it? And she said, oh, I don't want to do that. I don't want to play a single before that double because that's almost the final. And so she got on to Brugnon, who was the captain, and said to him, look, can you have it altered? Because I'm not going to play that single first. I'll play it the other way around, but not first. And I think that the message didn't get through to the referee in time for them to know that at 2 o'clock she wasn't going to be there. It's quite fair to say that she did send the message. There's no doubt about that. And so everybody waited for her on court one, you see, and she didn't turn up. She turned up at 3:30 in good time for her latest double. And then, you see, they rather went for her and said, why weren't you here? And she said, well, I sent a message to say I wouldn't play the single first. I'll play it afterwards. I don't mind at all. What made it so much worse was that Queen Mary had come down on purpose to see her because she did so enjoy watching Suzanne and Jean Barotra. Whenever they were down to play, she nearly always came. And nobody wanted to upset Queen Mary. She was so popular and it was so nice when she came. And they tried to get her to play her ladies' double at 5. And unfortunately, she was so upset over the whole thing that she wasn't fit. I mean, I could hear her, you know, sort of sobbing in the dressing room. I was very sorry about it all and still am.
Longlen pulled out of her singles and never played amateur tennis again. She died 12 years later from pernicious anemia. With Wills absent from Wimbledon with appendicitis, the way was open for McCain. But by then, she was no longer Kitty McCain. Back to that Leslie Godfrey chap she'd beaten in the Wimbledon mixed doubles final of 1924. He was better connected in the tennis world than she was. His claim to fame came from hitting the first ever shot on the centre court at Wimbledon when it opened in 1922. He loved telling the story that he served, his opponent Randolph Lycett returned, and Godfrey then hit the ball into the net, raced up to pick up the ball, put it in his pocket and kept it in his sock drawer, where the moths ate it. Kitty had known him on the tennis scene for several years, but no one knew they were close until they emerged from a long tour of tournaments in South Africa at the turn of 1926, having got married early one morning. Her daughter-in-law, indeed their daughter-in-law, Helen Godfrey, explains as much as Kitty ever revealed.
In those days, all the tournaments had mixed events and all the players of both sexes were present. I imagine they knew each other for a while beforehand, but it's not something she ever discussed. She only talked about him getting the train stopped and them getting married in South Africa whilst they were on tour on the 18th of January 1926.
So they married on the train?
Well, I think they actually married in somebody's house, but the train driver was persuaded to stop the train there at Kimberley and wait for a while, is what I was told. And then they went to somebody's house where they were married.
Seems a remarkable story.
It's an extraordinary story. He had been married before, she hadn't, and they chose to keep it a complete secret so that their parents, they could write to their parents and they could tell their parents before it got in the press.
Why?
I have absolutely no knowledge, Chris. It always seemed to me out of character for both of them. She never gave a hint as to why. She would just talk with being quite impressed that her husband had organised it all. I've actually no other knowledge at all.
When she won her mixed doubles title at Wimbledon in 1924, she beat him in the final. Do you have any idea whether there was a blossoming romance at that stage?
None whatsoever, I'm afraid. No, she didn't ever talk about it with glee that she'd beaten him or disappointment she hadn't been playing with him that year. It was just she was playing with Mr. Gilbert, wasn't she?
Yes.
No, she gave no hint as to any other feelings.
It was the start of another marvellous year for the newly married Kitty Godfrey. Having lost again to Wills in the 1925 US Women's Singles Final, she'd made up for her mixed doubles defeat 2 years earlier, she and Jack Hawkes beating Ermyntrude Harvey and Vinnie Richards in the final. Then the following year she reached the French doubles final, losing to Longlen and Julie Vlasto, her last ever match against Longlen as it turned out, and then did the same double at Wimbledon that she'd done in 1924. Her opponent in the singles final was Lily de Alvarez from Spain.
One of the most beautiful players. I mean, a lovely looking person to look at and beautiful shots. But she hadn't quite got the stamina. And at the end of the third set, she wasn't running quite so well as she had been.
Godfrey's stamina saw her to a second Wimbledon singles title, winning 6-2, 4-6, 6-3. And she had enough in the tank for a second Wimbledon mixed doubles title, this time with her husband. In fact, to this day, Kitty and Leslie Godfrey are the only husband and wife pair ever to win a major mixed doubles title. There's an unwritten rule at many tennis clubs around the world that you're playing with fire teaming up in mixed doubles with your domestic partner, which perhaps explains why it very seldom happens in professional tennis. So how did Kitty and Leslie manage it? Their daughter-in-law, Helen Godfrey, again.
I had the opportunity to know my father-in-law before he was my father-in-law, and at a lunch at Wimbledon, I was sitting next to him, and I asked him how unusual it was that they played together and won, because I thought that brothers and sisters, husbands and wives, often argue. And I said, how come that was something that worked for you? And he said, we didn't know each other well enough to argue, which I found quite staggering and didn't know where to go in the conversation.
They didn't know each other well enough, but they'd been married already.
They were married in the January, and they were playing together in the championships in June, July. So July they won it, but that's what he said.
That mixed doubles triumph in 1926 is obviously very special, because we believe it's the only time a husband and wife team have ever won a major mixed doubles title. Did they ever talk about it?
No, not that I ever heard. My mother-in-law would refer to the fact that she won the mixed in 24 and the mixed in 26, and she was quite pleased they'd won it. But, I mean, she was a very modest person. She never bragged about anything. People didn't know she had Olympic medals. She was very below the radar.
Was it also perhaps that Wimbledon didn't seem as big a deal in the 20s than it seems now? I mean, it's very much one of the world's great sporting events and brands as well. Might there have been something about the fact that she slightly underplayed the fact that she was a two-time Wimbledon singles champion and a two-time Wimbledon mixed doubles champion?
Yes, probably. I mean, tennis had only gone open in 1968. I think the whole way tennis is perceived now is very different from those days. Obviously, I can't go back to the 20s, but I think it was just all much more low-key. And because it was totally amateur, it was just a sport, you played it for fun. It's something she felt very, not fierce is the wrong word. She was very much of the opinion in the 80s, when she would have probably done the majority of interviews, that it was much more fun playing as an amateur without the pressure, without the razzmatazz, I was going to say, and having all tournaments were both men and women. So there's a lot more social life going on, a lot more time for yourself, whereas the present style well, all sport is it's a dedicated 100% plus life.
And we know from the Suzanne Longlen business that in those days, doubles was thought of as very important, almost the same level as singles. Did your parents-in-law think of their mixed doubles title as much of a success as a singles title?
I never had the opportunity to discuss it with both of them. She really valued the fact that they were the only married couple ever to have won the mixed. But she was so unbragging that I don't know. I think people told her more often that she'd won the singles twice than and didn't really think about the mixed, because mixed tennis was beginning to decline in its importance whilst she was still alive. And people focused on her Olympic medals and her singles championships much more than the mixed.
After giving birth in 1929, Kitty Godfrey returned to tennis in 1930 and played another 5 years of Wimbledon singles. In 31 and 32, by now in her mid-30s, she reached the fourth round, beaten on both occasions by champions Helen Jacobs and Helen Wills Moody. Strangely, by today's standards, Godfrey slipped into a form of obscurity after her playing days ended with the birth of her second child in 1937. Yet, as the Wimbledon centenary approached in 1977, the media discovered that she was the oldest surviving British Wimbledon champion and that she could talk very eloquently. That led to a rush of interviews with the by-now octogenarian, whose cut-glass accent and impeccable manners hid an often scathing view of interviewers who hadn't done their preparation before interviewing her. It's easy to think of the 1920s as a genteel era, when really, players were just as competitive as they are now. It's something Kitty Godfrey freely admitted to in that interview from 1981.
I think you'd say I had a fighting spirit, yes. I don't think I ever feel that I've lost a match until it's really lost. But I did play the type of game that the volleyer plays, a hit from the back of the court, with the idea of making an opening and then getting up to the net and then finishing it off, hopefully. I don't like the baseline play, just purely baseline. I think it's a bit dull.
Never backward in coming forward, Kitty McCain Godfrey. She was a club member at Wimbledon and a regular player there until she died on the Friday before the championships began in 1992. These days, a statue of her nestles in the Virginia Creeper at ground level on the south side of Centre Court, just along from the main entrance to the clubhouse. And it's likely a few more people may cast a glance towards it this year on the centenary of Kitty's second Wimbledon singles title and the only ever major mixed doubles title to be won by a husband and wife pair.
Chris Bowers on the steel behind the English rose that was Kitty McCain Godfrey. An absolutely fascinating look back to the 1920s, which was really the first boom period in the modern incarnation of tennis. If you enjoyed that look back at an earlier era of tennis, there's plenty more in the Tennis Worthy podcast collection. Just go to tennisfame.com/podcast and scroll down the list of our interviews and features. The Tennis Worthy podcast is brought to you by the International Tennis Hall of Fame. I'm Patrick McEnroe, and thanks for listening.